free speech and uninterested fascists. We thought it was right that we should be reminded of really what's at the back of all this, what hangs behind all this, what's the reality. And so we asked to come and speak with a guest speaker tonight, Leon Greenman, who is a survivor of the Holocaust. He's 83 years old. He's been speaking up and down the country for years now on his experiences, and we thought it right to remind us, the last speaker on the platform, to remind us of what really this is all about. We call upon him, Leon Greenman.
Thank you. Save it for afterwards, perhaps. Well, I've been listening now here to the gentleman. What is there left for me to say? I wish that these gentlemen could have spoken 10 or 15 or 20 years ago when I told people during my elections it's going to happen again, when they laughed, they shrugged their shoulders and didn't want to believe it. And God help you, but there's still beneath you, amongst you, who do not believe it. It's your own fault what happens to you. I'm going to try to take you back to the concentration camps. And that will be the cover of tonight's talk, because everything has already been mentioned. Where shall I start? Some of you know me already, so let me just go quickly. I derive from white Russian grandparents who escaped from white Russia because of the pogroms and anti-Semitism was raging there. I'm talking about 200 years ago. They escaped, came to England, and lived in the East End of London, where my mother was born. From father's side, I had Dutch grandparents who lived in America and in England. And that's where my father was born, in the East End of London. And that couple got together, got married, and produced 6 children. And I'm one of them. So according to British law, I'm a thorough Englishman. But that doesn't matter. I'm also a Jew. But as far as these in Holland, where it all started with me, the Nazi authorities and the Dutch authorities didn't think it worthwhile, my British nationality. They threw it away and stamped me a Dutch Jew because of my grandfather. I'm going to skip a lot now. You know, you read the books, how the Nazis worked. It happened on the 8th of October 1942. We were laying in bed. What else could we do? My wife, myself, and our baby boy, 2 years and 10 months of age. He never reached 3 years. The Nazis murdered him in the guest chambers with his mother. We had no radio, we had to give that up. No telephone. We were not to go anywhere in the town. No restaurants, no cafes, no cinemas. We had to do our shopping according to their laws between 3 and 5. Don't be inside a shop. Somebody might give you away if you could wait before or after that time, and you would be sent to Mauthausen. Terrible word at that time. So back to the 8th of October 1942, approximately 10:30, there's a ring at the door. Now who could that be? We're not allowed after 8 o'clock on the streets. I jumped out of bed. We lived on the first floor, up on the road. The door opened, the torchlight showing my face, and I heard a man's voice shout out, "Women!" And I answered, "Yes." And up stole 2 Rotterdam policemen, special police, to get the Jews out of their homes. And as he came upstairs, he said, "Get dressed and come along." I said, I don't need to come along with you. I'm a British subject. See here my birth certificate and some letters from the Swiss consul. Doesn't matter. While I was arguing with him, the other man was searching the room with my books. I was a bookseller, took some books and walked the cover from the wall. I said, leave them, please. That's my goods, my living. He said, you get them back when you come back. In the meantime, the baby was crying. Grandmother, an old lady, near 80 years, was crying. My wife started to cry. And then we gave in. We got dressed, picked up our rolled up blankets. We had them ready in case we were taken away. We went down the stairs. And in front of the house there was a coach. And inside the coach were already some Jewish families. And a young Nazi, about 6 foot tall, swastika band around his arm. And as we entered the coach, he told us to sit down and be quiet. And from street to street this coach went until it was full up with Jewish families. And then it went across Rotterdam, across the river Maas, and on the other side, on a piece of land where stood a load of large wooden huts. This hut was as big as this hall here, and that's where we were unloaded. And when I got inside the hut, I saw hundreds of Rotterdam Jews, amongst them a lot of my family and friends, also about a half a dozen SS soldiers. I went to one of them, showed him my birth certificate and a letter or two, and he waved them away. He said, you show them when you get to Westerbork. Westerbork is the assembly camp in the north of Holland, where Dutch Jewry had to assemble, and from there they were sent out to the various concentration camps. May I just mention that 104,000 Dutch Jews did not return from the camps. Rotterdam had 30,000 Jews, 12,000 did not return. And I lived in Rotterdam, and I'm one of those few that happened to come back. This was the 8th of October. 2 days later, we were put in a train and off we went to Westerbork. Arriving at a small village near Westerbork camp, Hooghoud. Does anybody in this audience that speaks Dutch? Can you follow what I'm talking? Call out the names, the Dutch names. We got out of the train. There were several hundreds of us, old, young, and babies. When we got out of the train, we had to walk 5 kilometers to the camp on a very muddy road, and it was pouring rain. When we arrived at Westerbork, we went inside to a barrack, a row of typewriters on the tables, and behind them a lady or gentleman, and you had to be registered. And that's how it went. Your name? Greenman. Leon, Jew, born in London. You're British? Yes, I'm British. And there were also American Dutch, people that were born in America and lived in Holland. I was born in London and I lived in Holland. And there was a barrack which we called the English barrack. In there we lived, the American Dutch and the British Dutch. The following day I was ordered to pull out with some men and a truck loaded with bricks. We went to this place where we arrived the day before, Hooghoud. And while we were unloading, I asked, what are we going to build with those bricks? And I was told we're building an SS barrack. An SS meant to be Germans, and I wasn't going to work for Germans. And when I got back in the evening, in Westerbork camp, I went to the barrack of labor and told them so. But I had to work. I wasn't an electrician, I wasn't a carpenter, so what could I do? So they made me Essenholer, the German word for getting food out of the kitchen, for my English barrack. Early in the morning, milk for the babies. In the afternoon, for lunchtime, for the donuts, and in the evening, a meal. That was my work, and I did it gladly. In my mind, I was working for my people and not for the Jerrys. The women slept in a different barrack, not together. Families were separated. So lovemaking didn't come to pass. If you do want to know, let us ask me afterwards. Life was very, very restful. There was no eating. There was no hunger, although we could have done with more food. But the head of the then of the administration in Reseborg, a German Jew, 6 foot tall, with a Hitler moustache, he was the chief of the administration department. And he would say whether you stay in Reseborg or were deported. And many times I asked this man for us to be set under Red Cross protection in a different camp. I said, life wasn't very too bad in Westerbork, but the babies were crying, the women were arriving, and a lot of sleep was missed. But this man never took notice of me. And it happened one early morning when a mate of mine told me that 200 men in Rotterdam were picked up from the streets the day before, and they were in the prison barrack 51 in Westerbork. And I thought, perhaps my father's amongst them. I went there, I couldn't go through the doors inside. I climbed up at the side of the window shelf, opened the window at the top, shouted my father's name, and yes, he was there. And while I was talking with my father, all of a sudden, my leg was pulled. And I heard a voice say, "Who is this?" The German voice of Kurt Schlesinger. And the man who pulled my leg, his assistant said, "This is the Englishman." And Schlesinger said, "Come down, or I'll send you to Auschwitz." I jumped down, stood in front of Kurt Schlesinger, and said, "You can't send me to Auschwitz. I told you we're a British subject. We waited for our documents to come along, and they can arrive any minute." And he walked away. A few months later, this is what happened. The lights go on in the barracks. On the table is a man with a sheet in his hand, paper. On the paper, the names of the people who are going to be deported. That was quite a shock when I heard, "Women, Lillian, get dressed, tomorrow morning deportation." "Esther, Lillian, Van Damme, that's my wife, get dressed, tomorrow morning deportation." "Bonnie, Lillian, our little baby," and so on. And nobody was there to help us. I hope that, what could we do? We were in the clutches of those people. And as half the safety stood outside my barrack, there were 750 Jews, young, old, and babies, men and women, ready to go to hell. We thought we were going to go to Auschwitz. That's all what we knew. Mauthausen, Dachau, and Auschwitz. We never heard of another camp. Now in the distance, from here to the door, there in this hall, I said to my wife, "Look, there's Kurt Schlesinger talking to Gernke, the SS commander. We'll walk that way, we'll stop at the side of Kurt Schlesinger, and now you tell him we need not be deported, our papers are on the way. We're British subjects, we need not go." And this is what she did. He gave us less than a second to look, turned to the SS commander and said, "Das ist abgewiesen, wir müssen weg." This has been refused in the Hague, and they got to go. We went through the gates, into the waiting train, and off we went, approximately 10:45. Totally, 93 trains left Holland during the occupation to the camps. That's why 104,000 Jews did not return. The journey took 36 hours. The one who was sitting in the train, this was still a passenger train, later on we get the empty cattle trucks. And while I was sitting opposite my wife, taking the baby in her arm in turns, the one who gave her sleep, and one of our thoughts was this, I called her Elsa, her name was Esther. Else, if I don't come back, I can be ill. We go to a cold country, we don't know how long it's going to be. If I don't come back, you may get married. See that you marry a decent man who's good for our baby. And she said, yes, that goes for you too. If I should be ill and I can't come back, you choose a good woman who will be all right for our baby. That was our talk and our thoughts. There was no drink, no food on that journey. 36 hours, and then the train stopped, and we heard a loud shouting, "Aussteigen, alles Wasser nehmen, schnell, schnell, schnell! Get out quick, leave everything in the train, leave it late, get out as quick as possible." We were half dozed, half asleep, half awake, but we got out of the train. And while we were standing there waiting, I was confronted with a huge heap of snow. And while I was looking here and there, from the snow were corners of suitcases. And I said to my wife, "Look at this, Els. If that snow gets inside the suitcases, everything in there will be spoiled." I did not know then that those suitcases were brought by the people to Westerbork, to a camp which I've never heard before, Birkenau, one of the greatest extermination camps that it was. There's still plenty there for you to go and have a look to prove. Those people were no more. Like ourselves, we'd come along, and they were no more. As we stood there, an SS sergeant separated the woman from the man. The man stood on my left, and on my right went the women. I told you 750 of us, men, women, and children, and babies. And I could still see one of us stood up there looking over to my wife, about 10, 15 yards. She threw me a kiss, and she did a hand to baby's mouth and threw me a kiss. And that was all right. I thought, I'll see my wife and kitty every weekend. That's what they told us. Never happened. All of a sudden, one of the women started to shout and scream and run away from where she stood towards her husband who stood amongst us. But she didn't make it. Halfway, this Nazi sergeant with a club in his hand, let the club come down on her head, and the poor woman dropped to the floor, to the ground, and he kicked in the tummy. A picture I'll never forget. But that was the first criminal incident by the Nazis I saw. And immediately he turned around to the man, and from those 200 men standing there, it was 750 people divided, 350 and 300 something, it counted 50 men by laying a club on my shoulders and his gloved hands. It went so quick, you didn't know, you couldn't think what was happening. 50 men, and we had to march away. And as we marched away, 10, 20 yards, all of a sudden, stop, halt, and we stood there wondering. Probably the picture was still in our mind, what we just saw by this woman. A truck comes along, stops in front of us. Now, I'm short. I wouldn't stand in front. I can see what's happening in front of me. The truck stops, and I see it's loaded with women and children. And in the middle, there stood my wife with our baby in her arm. Now, I know what you were thinking. How the hell does he know it was his wife? But I hope you don't think this. I recognized her face. I called her name. She didn't hear it. She didn't give no sign that she heard me. The truck, the engine of the truck was running. But my wife had made two garments from red, thick velvet curtains, covering the shoulders and half the body, but left the top in points, pointed heads attached to the rest of it. And those two points were looking at me, one in her arm and one on her own head. It was only a minute and the truck went away. And I never saw them again. But I do not know when, 2 hours later, the Nazis had killed them in their gas chambers. Where is David Irving? If there are any spies of David in the audience, tell them there were gas chambers. We ran and got order to march along. We march along, we stop in front of the barrack, and we hear a voice, "How many?" And the other voice who was guarding us said, 50. "I wanted 300. And the other one says, "All right, we'll take 250, the next lot that comes in." And I thought, we're sheep, we're cattle, we're being counted. Into the barrack we went. 2 men in the barrack. I showed them my birth certificate and a letter. They took them out of my hand and threw them to the floor. And when I looked, I was standing on a carpet of hundreds of photographs, envelopes and letters, wrote there by people who were around before we had arrived. But those people were no more. Later on, it all makes sense in my mind. But then not. But they were no more. Mass extermination took place in Birkenau. We had to strip, our best clothes went off, I had a thick winter coat, a lovely pullover my wife had knitted for me, and you stood there naked, those 50 Dutchmen, and then a prisoner with a pair of clippers, clipped our hair, no hair, the hair from underneath your arms, the hair between your legs, where I was sitting, next to the wooden seat, there was a bucket of paraffin oil, and a prisoner with a stick with some cloth on one end, dipped it in the paraffin oil, moved it over your head, between, under your arms and between your legs, and that was disinfection. And then you had to march into another barrack, and you got a hot shower. Lovely hot water. No soap. No towels. I never saw a piece of soap in my 3 years of concentration camp life. You had to dry yourself on your jacket, but you got used to it. But this is still in the beginning. As we stand there, a man comes in wearing a beret and Wellingtons. That was a carpool. A carpo is a kind of manager. And one of our fellows says, "Where are our wives and children?" And up goes his hand like that, pointing upwards. He held on there for a few seconds. And then he pointed it down, and he went. And we said to one another, "The man can't speak, something wrong with him." A few minutes later, he comes back, and another man of us asked him, "Where are our wives and children?" Again, the arm went up. He was not allowed to speak. You're not allowed to tell one another what happens in the camp. An SS might hear you, and you get kept into the gas chamber. Later on, I knew what that meant. I'll tell you. A And Frank would have told you the same thing. And you hear other survivors, and I hope those will come out and tell and talk to you like I'm talking. Remember, the trapped women arrived at the bath house, the bathroom. They were told they could have a shower after a long journey, a lovely shower. You undress, you're told to hang your clothes neat, place your shoes in a way that you can find them when you come out of the bath. We get into the chamber, the doors are closed, and you wait for water, but no water comes. At the top, from the ceiling, an SS usually, even wearing a gas mask, throws little pellets down from a tin. That's Cyclone B, a cyanide. And when it drops down, it takes 3 to 15 minutes and you've coughed yourself to death. That is killing in the gas chamber. You will read that in your books, but you don't want it to happen now again like I do it, or worse maybe. That's Nazi theory. Well, I've only got 10 minutes left to talk. Otherwise, I'll be sent to a camp. See you there. And there I couldn't get back, but I would now. All right. We get our number tattooed on our arm. My number is 98,288. You can read it on the colored poster outside, which is for sale. We need money, don't we? I won't charge you for an autograph. It's on there. And now we get drilled how to stand, how to walk, how to take off our belly, how to stand 5 at a time. It'll take too long to give you a demonstration. Everything will be kicking and beating and slapping. They made you so small, and you couldn't do nothing bad, not even look bad if they smacked you or kicked you. Don't look up and not that, just take it. You were there to work and to die. Those people, those carpos, those managers, were ex-murderers taken out of civilian prisons by the SS and dumped in concentration camps to govern us. And those people made your life every minute a misery. And around then you had the SS. But they did it with the guns. Well, I stuck for 2 months in Birkenau when the big selection came. Thousands of men had a strip passed between 2 tables. On each table stood an SS soldier. And if you couldn't walk properly, you'd be 2 months in Birkenau, you starved, you were beaten, what did you feel like? And if you couldn't walk properly, then the SS knew you were not fit to work, and you went to the left. And if you could still walk to the, and you had some flesh on your bum, you went to the right. That means those on the right could go on to Auschwitz and work until it was their turn to go to the gas chambers. And those people on the left, like the Dutch people behind me, I didn't see them anymore. That was Birkenau. And that evening, 1,500 prisoners marched under heavy guarding to Auschwitz. And in Auschwitz, the same life, hard labor, everything to do with building had to be unloaded under the trains that came daily. Millions of bricks I've carried, hundreds of weight of cement I've carried. One day I get called out of my barrack by a mate. He says he's a Dutchman, he just come from Holland. And he introduced himself as Mr. Jacobs. I said, well, what's your news in Holland? Is any good? He said, no, just as rotten when you left. But you are one of the most unluckiest men I've ever met and shall never forget. I said, how come you don't know me yet?
It is not, he said, yes, but the name Greenman I'll never forget. And this is what he tells me. When your train left about 1 hour 20 minutes after that, your name was placed in reservoir camp. Greenman, Greenman, come to the office. We found documents acknowledging your British nationality. But you were gone, your train had left. And I could do nothing about it. I was in Auschwitz. Who was here to help or to do? You think, oh, Senator Helen, I was doing the wrong thing, come sent to the prisons. None of that thing, I've seen enough. They'd never send you home. I was not to tell the outside world what happened. That comes later what I'm doing now. And you don't want that moving about to happen again to you, nor your babies, nor your people, whoever you are. Now, from Auschwitz I get selected, 200 men got to go to Nobelix, another camp. And that's where I lived, if you don't call it such, 17 months. The Russians were nearly Auschwitz. We knew the Germans were losing the war. Do you think they're pitying us? No fear. But the march from Nobelix to back to Auschwitz. And that's what did me good, back to liberty. But from Auschwitz, we went to Gladitz, still in Poland. They call this, in your books which you read, the death march. If you couldn't walk, that meant you held everything up behind you, you were shot. If you tried to run away in beautiful white fields, you were shot. And you had to walk. Non-stop. And then we reached Gladitz, 90 kilometers along. Gladitz was a small camp. None of us, or not all of us could get in. There was a lot of fighting amongst the boys and the men. And I didn't want to be hit. And I sat on a heap of wood, pulled my blanket around me. You weren't allowed to take a blanket with you. And I wanted to sleep. And I was dozing off when I got a picture in front of me. When I'm talking to you like that, I'm there again. I see it, I feel it, otherwise I can't do it. And a picture came into my mind of a Dutchman who said goodnight to us in Birkenau, and the next morning was frozen to death. And I believed I wanted to see my wife and child, so anything I did to stay alive. And I crawled around the barracks. I saw a window open. I let myself drop inside on top of a load of men, and I got my sleep. In Gladitz we stayed about 4 days, and then we had to go into open cattle trucks. And the truck where I was pushed and hit by a gun of the SS guard, which I was weak, like hundreds of hours. We couldn't walk out, we couldn't climb. There were too many people, you couldn't sit, stand, you just drop on top of one another. Open cattle trucks, and it was storming, freezing, snowing weather. And every morning, from the trucks, 4 or 5 or 6 men were taken out. They died. The journey from Gladitz to Buchenwald, that was the end of the journey, took 5 days. In Buchenwald I stayed 4 months. I could go and tell you the whole evening, but you want to get home, and we all want to get home. And I don't want to be sent to a camp for disobeying and all that. So, I'm going to make it quick. I stayed 4 months in Buchenwald. I've got to please this man here. 4 months, and on the 11th of April 1945, at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I crawled under my bed. I was sick, I was ill. I looked through the window and I saw no SS. No SS in the towers. A small airplane circling over Buchenwald camp. Dead still. And then I realized we were liberated by the Americans. And yes, at 6 o'clock, official The Americans had liberated Buchenwald, and they were long after the escaping Nazis. I did not leave Buchenwald straight away, but on 24th, 25th of April, I left Buchenwald. Running about on the airport, thinking that a plane could take me to Holland. It didn't happen that way. In the end, I went with an airplane to France. I had to go into hospital, the Hertford British Hospital in France, near Paris. And that's where my big toe was taken off of my left foot. It was dead. It was still rotten. And I couldn't walk. But in any case, my feet are still there. I didn't leave them in Buchenwald like a lot of men. The smell of rotten feet was so terrible that the doctor lifted up the blankets in the morning from every bed and said, cut, 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 cut. And when he came to me, I said, please don't cut. I'm an Englishman. These are just chilblains. And the Americans are coming along and liberate us. And please, I don't know where God is now. But the doctor didn't cut. It happened in Paris. In a decent way. Anyhow, I got back to Holland after a few months being made fit in France. In Holland, I didn't find any of my family. I missed 60 or 70 members of my Dutch family. The non-Jews, very few friends were there. Because when the Jews went, the Nazis took the non-Jews to work in Germany. This is not a Jewish question. 6 million Jews were killed. 4 million non-Jews were killed. 1 million gypsies were killed. 1.5 million babies were killed. What do you say about that? Don't shrug your shoulders from tonight on. Please remember what I tell you. You can look it up. And I won't tell a lie. Lies don't help. Because I never know who's sitting amongst you. I wish there were survivors amongst you. If there are, talk to me or shout out if I'm wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, I've got 3/4 now left. I'm not as good as one of those miserable ones, you know. But I told you part of my life. And when I got back to England on the 22nd November 1945, my two brothers who had been serving in the British Army, and I was in the concentration camps. They passed away a few years ago. They met me at Gravesend. And I spent a few weeks at my brother's house. I got very little money from the British Consul, 25 shillings a week. I couldn't do it. I complained, and then they said, I'll give you 10 more, 35 shillings. I had no clothes, I had no money, I had nothing. Somehow I had to eat, I had to pay where I was staying. And I said, give me enough money and coupons and I can buy myself a long coat. It was winter time, and that's what they did. I don't want no more money. And with a little attaché case, with small articles which I bought, I went on the markets, behind a stall, or fly pitching on the corners of the streets until the policeman chased you away, and that's how I commenced my life. I'm not married again, I know what the women are thinking. I've got no grandchildren. Only the Lord is looking after me. God bless you all.